Okay. Eric, yeah.
Hey, Charles, how are you doing?
Good, how are you doing, man?
Good.
It's been too long since we've done this.
Yes, and today we're in Building 99.
This is right.
This is right. Look at this beautiful space here.
Excellent. We've been here before.
Yes, and we're here with the two MSR researchers.
Hi.
Excellent.
Ben Zorn.
Ben Zorn.
And
two Bens.
Absolutely.
Big Bens. and today we're going to talk about all kind of cool stuff that they're doing with JavaScript.
Excellent.
So one of the things that they recently did is JS Meter. Before we go into that, I would like to ask you, where do all these funky names come from? You always have like, you know, really cool names. So,
oh, yeah. So, I don't know, somehow we feel compelled to name every single project that feels... You know, somehow it feels special when you submit a paper, if there's a name associated with it, you know, other than a very long title, somehow it stands out. That's at least one theory.
And I think really, in this day and age, a catchy name will stick with people. And stickiness, I mean, as much as research is about that, you know, the meat of the problem, stickiness is also important. And certainly finding a decent name. I mean, JS Meter, it's okay. You know, it's not going to win any awards. But at least it's distinctive, you know. And in fact, you know, we look up online to see if these names are being used by other projects.
Do you use Bing or Google, huh? Bing, of course.
But so these are guys are marketeers and researchers. It's great. So now tell us, what is JS Meter? Why not JS Mile? Or
We're using the metric system, I guess.
So at a high level, JS Meter is answering the question. What is JavaScript in your browser doing? And the
animating web
see,
pages.
Obviously, you can sort of see something
monkeys
happening. If you're a user, you know that JavaScript is doing something in there, and it's making it more interactive, more responsive, etc. But we ask the question: so, what is that code? I mean, there's code. Every JavaScript program is a program. There's source code there. What exactly is that code doing? And the issue becomes, is it code like other code? Is it like C code? Is it like Java code? Or is it something really different? And that's the question, the underlying question we wanted to ask with JS Meter. And the way we went about it was we took an implementation of IE, we changed the source code. So we essentially came to the point where we measured various aspects of program execution. And with that, then we got a picture in various dimensions of what was going on inside your JavaScript execution.
And so what was the, were there any kind of insights that you got and anything surprising?
Right. Well, so one thing that we went after pretty much right away was comparing sort of standard benchmarks that exist in this space with large applications. And these benchmarks are things like SunSpider and the V8 suite of benchmarks that people use for comparing browsers. And it turns out that these benchmarks are really very unrepresentative of what happens in large applications like, say, Amazon.com or Gmail or Bing Maps, that sort of thing. So basically, benchmarks are not really measuring anything that is, well, frankly, very interesting. It's just
that's kind of a universal truth,
it
right?
It is
right.
Universally right. True.
And
I
especially
think.
A lot of the JavaScript benchmarks seem to be just like Fortran programs,
exactly.
Kind of carried forward by some spider.
Exactly. In many ways, it would be surprising if they actually managed to measure anything of interest.
So one of the great things about the web, though, is that unlike these other spaces where, quote, a real program is like Office or, something, Windows, In the web space, a real program is just a web application. And everyone knows what those are, Gmail, Bing Maps, Facebook. These are real programs. We use them every day. And our goal in this project was to actually measure those programs.
Yep.
We're not going to tell you about some non-representative, even if they're big programs, non-representative programs. We're going to use the ones that you measure every day. That you use every day. Yeah.
Cool. So what are your conclusions?
Well, so comparing with the benchmarks, yes. I mean, that was kind of the easy first step, right? So it was really there for us to develop a methodology, which is what do we measure, how do we measure it? And so the approach to doing these measurements is really to take an instrumented version of Internet Explorer and kind of throw the whole bunch of sites. And luckily, Internet Explorer is capable of running just about anything somehow, and that way we can really get a lot of measurements, right? And as far as what exactly we measure, well, we look at a variety of things. We look at how much code is being executed, right? So how many lines of code, how many functions, how many bytecodes in terms of the interpreter, how big are these functions, do they have a lot of loops, do they cover a lot of ground in terms of the download, what is the size of the cold code, what is the working set size for these things, and then again, for every one of these dimensions, we compare real applications versus mm-hmm. the benchmarks conclude that just for just about every single dimension, the results are completely different.
Yeah.
We look at the memory sort of subsystem to figure out how much is being allocated. Is it really the JavaScript heap? Is it the DOM? Turns out that the JavaScript heap is actually not nearly as big as we first expected. It's actually DOM that's, I think, much more interesting and important in these large Ajax applications. What else? What happens to the garbage collector? Does it kick in often? What is the lifetime of a particular, of a typical object within JavaScript? Another interesting dimension of behavior that exists in JavaScript is that, the language and the runtime is set up so it's single-threaded, right? So there's a bunch of events that kick in and then basically run one after another. And what's interesting is that typically these events are very short-lived. If you look at Facebook, most of these events will run for, say, under 50 milliseconds. Very, very short, and that's really what drives applications' responsiveness. This is why you see, on Facebook, well, pretty much you click on just about anything and it responds very, very quickly. Whereas a poorly tuned website would actually not do that. It would go and run, say, a loop, and that would take, half a second or something like that, and it would show as not very responsive. Now, again, to sort of focus on that point, off-the-shelf benchmarks like SunSpider actually have, several handlers that run for a very long period of time. But the, lesson here is that when you're building a runtime, and I think there's a great number of lessons here for runtime builders, you really want to design your runtime so that it's able to execute really small pieces of code very, very fast. So you don't really want, when you're building your engine, you don't really want to design a locomotive. You want to, have something there that, is just kind of standing there and is able to react very, very fast.
But so how much of this is like chicken versus egg, right? Because the fact that JavaScript doesn't have threads kind of forces you into a model where you have you have timers and little kind of, event handlers. So is... So
one question you could ask is, will JavaScript evolve over time to capture some of the things that you see in traditional sort of native or at least more high-performance programming languages like Java or C#? And I think the high-level perspective there is that, JavaScript has evolved because it's very useful. It's widely deployed. Every browser basically implements it. It's got a standard. And it may be over time that standard will evolve. But the other way to look at it is that JavaScript is in an ecosystem. So it's not just a standalone language where all the applications are built, in JavaScript. It's part of the browser ecosystem, the web infrastructure ecosystem. And so transferring data over the web, having the browser sort of support part of the operation, having the JavaScript engine do another part, that separation is different than existing programming languages. And I think as a result, it will evolve, but I don't think it'll necessarily evolve like languages like C# or Java, for example. Yeah.
And so you said that, you saw that the benchmarks are not representative, but did you do similar measurements with, like, say that you take Outlook and Outlook WebAccess, right, which are very similar from the user perspective, right, they're trying to make them look very similar.
Sure.
Did you do that, and did you see kind of, difference in profile?
We don't have a direct comparison against native apps like Outlook. That would be a really interesting comparison. And there is some prior work on studying applications written in C++. I think the more direct comparison we can make is between some of the work that's been done with Java, measuring Java and JavaScript. And I think there we see that JavaScript, It's not a full-purpose language like most languages. Mostly it's generating strings. When you think of a Java program, you don't think, oh, there's millions of strings, right? It's all in Java. It's all about objects, right? And can we make objects efficient? So I think what you'll see is, if you look at these comparisons, you'll see JavaScript is really a glue language. It's gluing together the DOM, you know, the document, which is in HTML, and some functionality, which isn't necessarily even implemented, you know, in the JavaScript. So, you know, you, if you need to do a loop, you probably don't want to write a loop, a for loop, to loop over, say, every element of the DOM. There's mechanisms in the DOM APIs, like getElementById, that allow you to, you know, go directly to the element you want. And so I think that's why JavaScript is very different than these other languages. And it's, like I said, it's co-evolving. I mean, one of the interesting things about JavaScript is that it's got a second heap. It's got its own heap with data. Then it's got the DOM, right? And it can put things in the DOM. It can take things out of the DOM. It's like a persistent heap. You know, in fact, the way I think about JavaScript is it's almost like a persistent programming language in that it's got this part of it that basically just sits there. You know, it doesn't, even if the JavaScript dies completely, the application isn't dead because your browser still can display whatever HTML is sitting there.
So another big difference, like, you know, people, I think a lot of people get confused, right? Because JavaScript and Java, you know, there's a common prefix, but the languages couldn't be different. Yeah, and they have curly braces both. One of the differences is that JavaScript is, like, dynamically typed. And so did you kind of see, are people really using eval and kind of, you know, dynamic objects a lot? And things like, you know, prototype inheritance or, you know, messing around with that.
Well, so clearly people do use eval. That's what makes it, for instance, difficult to analyze statically, which is what we are doing as well as part of a different project. The use of eval is fairly stylized, which is to say that, you know, people would use it to evaluate JSON, and there are better mechanisms in the browser for that purpose. There are certain other scenarios where eval is, perhaps called for, maybe not. Some of them can be sort of simplified away, others are more difficult to deal with. I think what we see more and more as time progresses is people generating JavaScript from other high-level languages, which is to say that they don't program in it directly. They use a tool like ScriptSharp or GWT to actually produce the code. In which case, well, you are as a sort of translator writer or compiler writer on the you have much better control over what to generate and what not to generate, obviously. And, for instance, you can you know, produce information about types that come from the source language, in which case, you know, the engine would be much better equipped to pick that information and so forth.
So let's drill down a little bit. I have a little bit of experience in this area, too.
Of course.
So one of the difficulties is when you target JavaScript is that it's hard to maintain invariance of your source language in JavaScript. For example, JavaScript arrays are not like regular arrays. So in order to maintain the array semantics, you know, you have to do a lot of work. So any thoughts about that? Like, you know, are people trying to encode, you know, certain constructs in JavaScript, and then, you know, how can they enforce that?
Well,
these invariants.
So I think, you know, one aspect of this measurement, you know, as you're asking, you know, is understanding how JavaScript is being used in practice, and then from that you can infer if you made constraints, if you basically said no eval, so how much impact that would have both on existing websites and on future elements. And so, you know, we have colleagues at Purdue University that are looking at the same problem, actually, and one of their goals is to actually understand if they were to design a static type system for JavaScript, you know, what should it look like? How could they make it compatible? And those are important questions. I think that the reality is that there's two tensions. There's the tension to make JavaScript more static, because, you know, the benefits are easier to type check, you know, statically, easier to get rid of the bugs, faster execution potentially. So that's a very positive, you know, trend. And of course, JavaScript kind of fights back because, you know, it's dynamic at its very core. But the flip side of that is that there are people thinking in terms of, you know, can we make, you know, highly dynamic frameworks, basically frameworks that have some kind of meta object protocol embedded in them, in which case those are going to sort of thrive on the dynamic aspects of JavaScript. And I think there is this tension because, you know, the kind of the future of dynamic frameworks may evolve in some new website, you know, some new framework that gets adopted by a very, very popular website, in which case, you know, all this throwing, trying to make it more static will just go out the door because ultimately it's about what people want to use in JavaScript. It's not about you know, whether or not us language people say, this is the best language, this is the best feature, et cetera.
But ultimately, and pragmatically, if you go look at the popular sites the way we did, you see the following categories there. You see sites that use frameworks like jQuery and Prototype. There are a lot of sites like that. You see sites that are generated by translators like, say, ScriptSharp, and again, there are a lot of sites like that. Many Microsoft properties are generated precisely that way. And then you see sites that use handwritten code. And actually, among the really big ones, those, I think, are the minority at this point, just because it's so difficult, because of the dynamicity of the language to manage, you know, programs that are over 100,000 lines of code. It's just a huge challenge, and people kind of give up. So, and 100,000 lines of code is fairly commonplace these days. I mean, look at Bing Maps or Gmail, or Facebook is a bit smaller, but still it's not that small. And going forward, I mean, when you have things like Office for the Web, I mean, there are reasons to believe that those would get bigger still. And given these sizes, how do you manage to develop them and update and maintain them and debug, profile, get bug reports from the field? I mean, all of these questions that have been avoided for such a long time just because your traditional JavaScript program was 17 lines. Now they are back with a vengeance, essentially.
Another interesting aspect of JavaScript is that it's really also a functional language, right? It has closures, first-class closures. Did you see or did you measure, if people are using jQuery? Obviously, uses a lot of higher order functions.
Yes.
Do you see that? And do you see how deeply they're nested? Do they use third order functions or fifth order, or are they usually just just one delegate or function that you pass?
So our measurements didn't directly address that particular question. Some of the work that Jan Vitek has done at Purdue does, and he's got a paper coming out on PLDI this year in June that investigates some of these issues. I think my perspective is that for the most part, these kind of dynamic features or functional features aren't heavily used. I mean, there is sort of the there's the JavaScript, the best parts kind of style, where it tells you, this is the right strategy. Basically, write JavaScript as if it were a functional language. I think there is an influence there. But in the end, there's also the interactive nature. I mean, a lot of JavaScript is there to generate, DOM elements that sort of get, propagated into the... So much of what happens in the JavaScript is very simple code that's handling relatively small events, responding, putting up some new menu or, hovering over something and presenting some information. So I would say, a large fraction, and one of the things that makes JavaScript compelling is that you can do interesting things with small amounts of code. And as a programmer, these sort of complexities, the sort of sophistication of writing functional programs isn't either necessary or in particular accessible to everyone.
So in practice, we see things that get as hard as using delegates, which is to say not very hard. Right. Really, the complexity, the most complexity you find is in frameworks. Right. Frameworks writers really have to understand what's going on, and they take advantage of sophisticated features like closures and hiding things within closures and using that for privatizing members and so forth. Or compiler writers, basically people who translate into JavaScript. Outside of that, it's relatively rare to see really complex JavaScript. Every once in a while, people would go and attach things to the string object just because they feel like it, or they would attach fields to an object for tracking an aspect like features. Mm-hmm. But that's as much as you see. You don't really see too much else.
Okay, so that's a kind of interesting point that you bring up. So, I can attach something, to the string object.
Yes.
There's a possibility that things are clashing. The two libraries might have their. Did you find any examples where libraries stumble over each other?
Yeah, this is an interesting discussion. So we actually did some static checking in this space when we focused on widgets on my.ly.com, the gallery site. They used to be around, and yes, we discovered that in many, many cases, you put two widgets of the same kind side by side, there'll be sort of essentially the race conditions every which way, certainly. The other thing is that many sites, and again, you see whole variety, a whole range in terms of a spectrum, in terms of the skill levels of these developers. Mm-hmm. But for sites, for instance, like news sites, oftentimes the way those are composed is essentially by throwing things together. They would be iframed away from each other to prevent those sorts of collisions. But if you actually look at what gets, you know, pulled in, there'll be like two or three copies of the jQuery library with different versions, just because they don't know how to resolve version conflicts. They don't really want to deal with that. And so that's why if you look at, I'm not going to name any names, but if you look at some popular news sites, they're extremely heavy, very inefficient, just because of this style of programming where essentially this really crude isolation mechanism of iframes and using separate domains if necessary kind of encourages this sloppiness. And clearly, you know, in standalone sites, like, say, Gmail, that really wouldn't be the case because they really worry about the download size, they worry about the ability to write extensions and so forth.
So, and from this research, if there's, like, anything that you could take out of JavaScript or add to JavaScript, what would it be? Let's give an example of, you know, one thing to take out and one thing that you would add.
You want to add anything?
That's a good question.
Well, if you can only add something if you first remove
something.
Yeah,
throw something out. There you go. That's a tough one.
Well, I think one topic for discussion is the subsetting mechanism, right? And that's been kind of working its way through the standards body, I suppose. And it's not quite clear what state it's in, but, you know, there's been a great deal of discussion and a number of proposals to limit the expressive power of JavaScript to say that, well, if you're writing an ad, you should only use a particular subset of JavaScript so that it's easier to check it, easier to enforce properties, easier to make sure that the ad is not going to go completely wild and, you know, destroy the rest of the page, that sort of thing. Having sort of a customizable mechanism for ensuring these things within the browser, not so much within the language, but it's kind of related to the language at the runtime, would really be very beneficial. I think that's about taking things away, largely speaking. Now, what do you want to add?
Yeah, features. Wow. I mean, I think, you know, at some level you can say, well, it's so dynamic that you can get the effect of almost any feature you can think of.
That's right.
By composing various dynamic aspects. But I think, too, that, you know, at some level, the kind of the core approach of building things on prototypes as opposed to having a class-based language, you know, it's a fundamental change of perspective for many developers, right?
Yeah.
And so you see people recreating classes in JavaScript in various ways, and, you know, because it's much easier for them to reason about. So, you know, it's kind of heretical, probably, but ultimately I think, you know, the question of whether or not prototypes are sort of the right mechanism in which to build this kind of system, you know, is open. I mean, clearly it's been very effective so far, but it does lend itself to these issues that we're talking about. So
for the non-experts in the audience and,
yep,
and the idiot behind the camera as well, talk a little bit about the differences between prototypes and classes, because it's not immediately obvious to everybody.
Sure. Okay. So most object-oriented languages that you use, think of, you know, C#, C++, Java, have this notion of a class, which is you can think of it as a descriptor for many instances of objects. So each object belongs to a particular class. The class defines what the methods of the object can have are, what the fields of the object can have are. Basically, all there is about the behavior of the object. In JavaScript, the strategy is quite different. In fact, it's based on this work by David Unger on a language called Self. And the underlying idea is that there's no classes in JavaScript. There's just objects. So if you want to make an object that has characteristics in common with other objects, you clone the object. And ultimately, that object that you use as the base of the cloning is the prototype object. Mm. Okay, but it allows you to have very, very dynamic sort of organizations of data. So every prototype, every object can itself become sort of what you can think of as a class, and you can create instances from that. You can add or subtract fields from arbitrary objects. The lookup method to determine whether a particular field or method is defined by an object involves, you know, looking through the chain of prototypes, which itself can be dynamically reconfigured, etc. So in many ways, a prototype-based approach is flexible, it's dynamic, it has to be implemented at runtime, because you can't ahead of time reason about the relationship between objects and the classes that they belong to. But in fact, if you look at the implementation, like the V8 implementation, many of these strategies are basically, they take JavaScript and they map it into a class-based language, essentially. So they assume that you're not going to do too many clever things with prototypes and changing the prototype chains and the methods. But in fact, the reality is that most programs don't do that, don't use this dynamic aspect, and so they have essentially shadow classes. Every time you add a field, it creates a class that corresponds to that field. And they have essentially, V tables, sort of quick lookup tables for all the methods, et cetera.
I mean, it's interesting. People have looked at this, extreme degree of dynamicity in the context of Smalltalk and stuff, I suppose, as well. And they say, if you have this program that runs for 25 years, then it's really beneficial to have this ability to change things around, after year two, say, to add extra behavior, to remove behaviors, or to add a versioning or what have you, and you can have this ability on the fly. And, it sounds pretty great if, like I said, you have a program that runs for 25 years, but, in the context of JavaScript, these things, most pages or applications run for, say, under a minute, so perhaps that dynamicity is not really called for. Moreover, it's actually quite often for the site to change its code. If you go and look at how often a site, like, say, Amazon changes the JavaScript behind it, or, say, Bing Maps, it's actually a lot, right? Mm-hmm. Could be, like, every week or something, or could be every day for that matter. Facebook is notorious for changing their JavaScript every which way, seems like every Friday or something. But
like a set of patch Tuesday.
Right, you would never know, too. Yes. I mean, that's kind of the beauty of Facebook.
I think I'm in a very unlucky bucket or something that's happening there. And so, you could ask, well, is it really appropriate for a language that to have this much power where it's also combined with a web platform that is so transient in many ways, right? It's unclear.
So, and one of the things, the dangers that I see, potential dangers with this prototype-based approach is what people call monkey patching,
right?
Where, like, I have a value, and now I pass it, to one of the bands, and they can freely add and remove, fields and methods, and now I get back the same value, and now suddenly it's a completely different thing. It has, changed. Huh. So, again, it's really hard to make any assumptions about things that you pass around. It's mutability on steroids.
It's a tremendously dangerous mechanism, right? I mean, there is that monkey patching, but I mean, the fact that you so if you think about it, what is the power of the web? The power of the web is to be able to take both data and code from different hosts, from different servers, and compose it around. Do this lead binding to compose a nice-looking page in your browser, right? So in particular, in the context of code or JavaScript or what have you, really could be even Silverlight for that matter. The ability to take a library like jQuery from this server and then the rest of the code from your server, for instance, is paramount. That's actually what makes this the web platform both powerful and interesting and also unique. But if you think about it for just a second, it's also very dangerous, right? You don't know anything about, what that file that you're referencing on somebody else's server, you don't know what it's going to be like. You don't know how it's going to link with your code. You don't know what they're going to add. You don't know what they're going to remove. So while, this ability to do very late binding is very powerful because hopefully they'll actually do what you expect them to and add nice features and improve performance, it's also very dangerous just because you lose all control that you used to have.
But so, I think, too, I mean, part of the issue there is that you're in a safe environment. One of the great things about the browser is that basically things that run in the browser in JavaScript, ultimately can't do that much harm, or at least that's the belief, basically.
No, but that's not
so, you did a lot of work on kind of security stuff in the browser, and now the other band is saying that there's no problem.
So there's security and then there's security. So I was actually referring to the point, the different point, which is reliability, fragility, right?
Sure.
Model is very fragile.
Right. Sure.
That's why you see people copying 15 different versions of jQuery to their hard drive and then serving it from there, which really defeats the purpose of this, if you think about it. But the question is, again, like I was saying just a second ago, there is this tension between this expressive power of essentially programming over the web, and they need to have some form of control in the form of, say, I don't know, contracts or something that would actually allow you to make sure that you are using the right thing.
I would argue, though, that the lack of this kind of control is actually what makes the web so wonderful. Is it basically you can bring together all this random code from random places,
yes,
and run it in a context. You don't have to worry about it, you know, screwing up your system. Most of the time it works. When some part of it fails, the rest is still okay. I mean, most, you know, if you have an ad on a web page and
yes,
the ad has broken JavaScript, it doesn't usually make the whole web page unusable.
Yes, sir.
And so I think one of the great things about this kind of model is that you have this, it's not as fragile. And it allows for lots of stuff to come together, some of which may be broken. It's very forgiving. And
but then what about things like cross-site scripting and those kind of things?
Well,
so, I mean, they are in some sense also ultimately caused by the fact that, you know, you can interpret strings or data as code.
Absolutely.
So how does that...
Right. So I see it as a tension of sorts, right? We started by talking about, you know, these different types of programmers, right? And so the platform is extremely forgiving, I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
And then it provides very graceful degradation. You see, like, a blank area on the page where an ad used to be just a second ago. Well, fine, no ad, I guess. It's fine in a certain sense, but it's also something that makes large-scale kind of development of applications that are supposed to be mission-critical very, very challenging. You have to basically change the model and go back to a much more tightly controlled, kind of much more static model. And we see both. We see this language and platform allowing for very sort of, if you will, cavalier kind of approach to programming. Oh, let's just throw some code every which way and then some of it will work. Somebody will stick, and if it doesn't, well, nobody dies. That kind of approach versus the approach that is taken by sort of highly tuned monolithic applications. If you look at how, say, Bing Maps, you know, is built, or Gmail, or what have you, Facebook, for that matter, too, certainly that's not the approach they take. So it's about exercising discipline and really, you know, picking and choosing. Right, I mean, it's just like they say about C++. Nobody uses the entire language.
Mm-hmm.
People choose a subset of features and then run with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the same is more or less happening in JavaScript, except that I think it's a mistake to just talk about the language. I really like to be talking about the platform,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Because the language is, well, is really quite tightly coupled with the rest of the platform. And I think, you know, there is a tremendous amount of interplay. And that's what we noticed as a result of JS Meter, right? Many of the ideas that come out of JS Meter, if you look at our papers, are about how to make the runtime better, but also how to make the underlying platform better. And let me give you a couple of examples that come out of our studies. So, for instance, we noticed that many, many pages are short-lived, right? And in the browser, you know, that information is probably available. We know that, you know, if you came to this page a week ago and there was only a tiny bit of JavaScript run in the beginning, well, most likely that's probably going to be the case. So if that is the case, then really there is no need to, say, run the garbage collector, because these days browsers allocate a process per page, and let's just allocate memory, and then let's just kill the process. There's really no need to waste time on garbage collection, no need to stop the execution or slow it down, and that's great. So that's one very, very simple lesson that comes you know, out of just looking at the interaction of the platform and the language runtime. Another example of a similar sort is, well, what happens if you go to the same page over and over and over again, right? And that happens in the web context,
mm-hmm,
very, very frequently. You go back to a search page, you go back to, say, Amazon, because, or you go back to, like, the ACM Digital Library page, because I'm constantly looking for these
or
papers.
Microsoft.com.
Or something, right. So what happens there, right? So currently the browser would cache the JavaScript code as
yep,
a file, and then would proceed to sort of diligently recreate, query parse it, create the structure in memory, and then proceed to run it. Well, generally speaking, there is really no reason to do any of that. The AST, so whatever representation the browser, I'm sorry, the runtime uses, could be cached, and you know, that time could be saved, you know, time and time again, just because you go back to the page. Again, yet another example of a particular interaction, right? So this insight about how the platform is being used, combined with ideas from the language world, really gives you, I think, the most power. I think it's again, a mistake to just look at the language and maybe try to only compare it to, say, I don't know, Scheme or C++ or what have you.
So, but maybe when we talked about like adding and removing things, one thing that I always find surprising is that the DOM and the language are kind of, you know, defined completely separately.
Yes.
Right? If you look at the JavaScript language specification, it says nothing about the DOM. And
right.
If you look at the DOM, it says relatively little about JavaScript. So mm-hmm. would you suggest that maybe, you know, these things should be more tightly integrated, like even in the specification?
Well, so there, one question you ask is, you know, is it an issue of the specification or the implementation? I mean, you can have a nicely separated definitions and have the implementation. You know, most current browser implementations don't do this, but you can imagine implementing the DOM as part of the JavaScript heap, basically. So, you know, so a lot of that DOM now is actually part of the browser implementation, which is in the underlying native code runtime, typically.
Yeah.
So there's a boundary there which you pay a lot to cross, you know, but that's a cost. It's an implementation cost. It's not necessarily conceptual.
But if you look like other languages, like, you know, say C# or VB or C++ or C or Java, it's usually the language plus a large set of libraries,
mm-hmm.
and
right.
where the
right.
language ends and the library begins is often not clear. Whereas with JavaScript, it's kind of funny
well
that there's very
yeah.
kind of
yeah.
strict separation.
Yeah.
Whereas in practice, as you say,
right.
You know, it's really blurry.
Well, so I'm not really too sure about the standards, right? I mean, clearly in practice, if you look at how large high-performance applications are written, we see the same set of lessons time and time again, which is you have to pay a lot of attention to this boundary, right? The boundary between JavaScript and the DOM is actually somewhat artificial. The way it developed is that, you know, it used to be that it would mostly be the DOM, right? You would just download your,
yes, yeah.
well, pretty much,
yeah.
right? You would download your HTML page, and then the browser would kick in, and then it would run for a while, like a locomotive, and then finally it would figure out how to lay the page out, and then it would display it to the script. That's how it was, say, I don't know, 15, 10 years ago. Nowadays, the picture is very, very different. So this boundary crossing, right, this border crossing is happening all the time. Between JavaScript and the DOM and so on and so forth. These things go back and forth, back and forth. And so you're paying tremendously for that ability to cross that border. Moreover, in some sense, you could argue that for complex applications, the initial parsing of the DOM, I mean of the HTML, is actually not a big deal. You know, you just do it once and the locomotive is really very fast. But that's not really what slows you down. It's actually the fact that you have to constantly update and refresh that page that slows you down. And then the browser, just like I was saying about JavaScript, the browser is also not particularly designed for doing these little incremental updates. So if your goal is responsiveness at the end of the day, because that's what the user notices, you have to rethink how you build both parts of this, you know, underlying infrastructure, actually. Mm-hmm. That's certainly what we are seeing. Now, from a language standpoint, I think it's also very interesting. I was already kind of starting to talk about that. I think it's, I mean, what we see in JS Meter is that JavaScript heaps, if you just look at the heap size, they're not really that huge. Most of them actually are relatively small. If you compare them to, say, Java heaps or C# heaps, there's really not that much interesting stuff going on. Really, much of the interesting stuff is actually happening in the DOM. So it's kind of a mistake to focus as a language researcher just on the heap that the JavaScript mm-hmm. provides. You really have to figure out what's happening within the DOM. And the DOM is actually, you know, there's quite a bit of novelty there, right? It's an interesting data structure. It's tree-like. There are manipulation routines, there are APIs and whatnot. You can try to figure out what's actually happening. You can try to do analysis. You can try to do optimizations, what have you. But I think that's where the interesting language part comes from, which is to say, it's not quite a library. It's actually more than that.
Mm-hmm.
Really, if you think about the surrounding runtime, you really have to, you know, essentially pull it in. You cannot just, you know, think about it as a black box and then there's some sort of a boundary and you forget about it. You can, because that's what we've been doing for like 10 years
yep.
in terms of browser, you know, building and development. And, you know, the results are not that great. So I think it might be time to sort of rethink that approach and actually or sort of figure out something.
And another question to talk about, like, you know, the DOM and so on, is that, like, if you're trying to write JavaScript, you have to deal with all the different browsers and the different versions and so on. And in, like, you know, it feels when I write, you know, code, is that that's where I'm spending a lot of time, right? But now the question is, do you also see that, you know, in the code that you execute, or is that more like, you know, that the programmer sees that, but, you know, at runtime, you know, it doesn't put that much overhead on the, or did you not measure that specifically?
Overhead in the execution?
I mean, yeah, I, or how well, much of the execution the, right, is kind of, like, yeah, end yeah. up is like I to mean, do cross-browser stuff?
Yeah.
So I think that certainly it's going to have an effect on the, you know, the amount of branching you're doing, essentially. Yeah. You're going to be doing these tests to see which browser. And probably, you know, maybe they'll be in these event loops, you know, in sort of the tight code. I don't think we saw a really substantial effect from that in the total execution time. The actual web applications, you know, are, you know, they're, let's see, what's the right way to put it? They don't execute that much code. I mean, you, when you think about sort of using it, a lot of what's going on is not executing the JavaScript bytecodes or, you know, whatever, the JIT code. Because, as we're talking about, there's many of these crossings with the DOM. Those are taking a lot of time. And, you know, obviously improving the JIT, you know, the quality of the JIT is good. I mean, I think, you know, if you look at Firefox, the work that Firefox, Safari, Chrome have done has been very effective. But I think in the end, you know, that'll only get you so far. It's pretty well understood that you can eliminate a lot of that overhead. It's being done, but I think in the end, it's going to be these interactions with the DOM. It's going to be sort of the broader issues around the runtime that are going to make a difference.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, if I can make a prediction, we'll see what comes true. But
we only need one computer?
Six was the number.
Oh, six.
But let me make this 42. Prediction, which is we'll see more progress in terms of JavaScript runtimes. We'll see more progress in DOM and browser implementations. But I think here's something that's fundamental about many of these programs, which is they're network bound, right? We used to talk about, you know, I/O bound programs or memory bound, that sort of thing. These applications, large scale AJAX or Silverlight applications, are network bound. You have to get something from the server. You have to go to, someplace in a data center and fetch that data. And even if the bandwidth is, great, and, you know, bandwidth is getting higher even in an international setting, even on a cell phone, it's getting better and better. Well, the speed of light is what it is. Mm-hmm. So unless you can afford to have tons and tons of data centers all over the place, you're still limited by that. So the latency sort of kills you sort of every time.
Mm-hmm. So the latency of downloading scripts or pages?
It's downloading script, and we've done some work on that. There's the other project that focuses on how to minimize the amount of script you have to download. But ultimately, as the program executes, you have to get data. If you have a mapping application, you have to get map information. You have to get directions. You have to have information about traffic. You have to constantly get updates from some sort of a server, right, a data center, what have you. And how to do it cleverly is a very big challenge. And currently, developers don't often realize, what portion of their application is going to cause a request. They don't really know how expensive that might be. They don't really understand how expensive it might be in terms of power, right? Because on a cell phone, the cost of a send request is tremendous in terms of the battery, impact. So I think that actually goes beyond really even the language and sort of touches some of the inherent programmability challenges of this platform.
So did you guys measure, like, how much time actually is kind of spent waiting for, an XML HTTP request to come back,
We were actually in the JavaScript engine itself, so we weren't measuring the round trip times for the requests.
There are some tools for that, though. I mean, these days, the tooling is getting so much better than it used to be even a year ago. We contributed to some of that on the IE side. But, all over the board, all across the board, really, the tooling is getting really nice.
Realistically, people understand, that the performance issues break down into these categories. And I think what will happen is people will find it's the old whack-a-mole. You find the biggest performance impact, you knock it down, and then you find the next one. And
it's also what can you do? Really?
Yes, exactly. Right. Right.
This goes to this issue about caching. I think what Ben's talking about in terms of the future is that so caching data locally has been something that's been done a long time, right? But one of the questions, one of the issues with caching is, well, what do you cache? And obviously that becomes harder because as you have so much data from the web, so that becomes an issue. But on the other hand, we have exponentially increasing amounts of local memory, in some sense. And the other question becomes, do you cache it at the sort of the page level, or do you actually bring it into memory? Do you cache the memory image or some equivalent of the memory image?
Or maybe, if we talk here, in 5 years now, why don't we just kind of install a program locally and run it from there?
Of course. I mean, there are all sorts of interesting models starting to develop, right? So people talk about replicated execution. You kind of run it partially on the server, you run it partially on the client, you can combine the results together. We've done some work in that space. You can run it entirely on the client. Then there are interesting security applications that come out of that, which is, do you trust the result, right? Mm-hmm. If the server ever has to consume what's been computed in the client, why would they ever trust the result that the client provides? That sort of thing. So there are some really cool, I think there is still room for some really cool work about, on execution models and how to kind of run things and that sort of thing. But actually, to go back to your question about browsing compatibilities, I think that focus is a little bit misplaced. I don't think that, I've looked at tons and tons of this code in the past several years. And yes, there are some, there's a little bit of code that usually goes into a large application that accounts for browser differences, sure. But, by and large, it's not that big a deal. Right? So yes, there are differences. Yes, they'll probably get smaller over time and so forth. But it's not really something that's going to make break it for you. It's not really that difficult in kind of for development. It doesn't really make things that much more difficult, especially if you use libraries and frameworks. Well, you manage. All the different JVMs, they're really quite different at the end of the day, especially say on a mobile platform. They're really, really different. Makes for a real challenge. So in this space, the fact that there are differences, sure, but I don't think it's a big deal.
You say that's just a burden, the cost that the developers have to carry.
It's a startup cost. It's a startup cost, pretty much.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what HTML5 does to impact the evolution of JavaScript, right?
Yep.
HTML5 will be brand new ways to program things inside of the browser besides what we're used to, without having to bring in COM objects to do the work for us.
Mm-hmm. So talk about that. There's also, if you look at the browsers, there's also CSS, which itself is kind of a programming language too. It's
that's right.
It doesn't have kind of control flow, but still you can write complicated style sheets that must somehow impact the execution as well. Did you measure that as well?
We do not measure that. Don't look at that aspect of it. People in the past have, right? So IE has published numbers. There were, I think, two Velocity conference presentations focusing on that, focusing on the sort of cost of layout as well as CSS, how that impacts things. I mean, again, it's this sort of unholy trinity, right? JavaScript, HTML, and CSS.
Yeah.
And in many ways, it's great for programmability. It's easy, very easy to get started and very easy to kind of add to things. But once you have it, you're kind of stuck with it. And it's actually fairly difficult to go and re-implement a runtime, a browser from scratch. A JavaScript engine is probably not that much work, but figuring out the complexities of CSS is
the standards as the standards evolve.
The spec is rather thick, right. But then beyond the spec.
But the other side of that is, I think that the fact that you've got issues around parallelism imply that ultimately people are going to want to have a definition of CSS and of HTML that basically allows it to be rendered in parallel, right? Mm-hmm. And right now, there's too much stuff in there that prevents that or mm-hmm. makes it difficult. There's work, interesting work by Ross Boddock at Berkeley that is trying to think about how you could decouple some of the issues in rendering to make it faster.
Absolutely.
And so I think there's a lot of very interesting future research there. I think it'll take, it'll be years and years before it becomes the standard. But I mm-hmm. think ultimately that there'll be a lot of pressure to make that possible.
Well, you'd hope so, because we keep talking about, Eric, we've had so many
yes.
conversations I can't even remember anymore on parallelism
yes.
and currency. You'd expect the browser to be able
right.
to take
yes.
advantage of 1,000 cores if we ever get there.
Yes, yeah.
But you know what I'm saying.
Especially
yeah.
on your phone. Right?
Yeah. yeah. But hey, you guys, there's people
yes.
waiting.
All right.
This is good.
Yep.
And they're about to walk in. Maybe we should get them on camera. Ask them what they're going to talk about.
All
hey.
Right. Well, thanks
well,
a
thank
lot.
You, Eric.
Yes, and,
great.
And there's lots
thank
of
so
plenty
much.
Of
awesome.
Future work. So,
yeah.
yes,
well,
great.
We've got Ben
thanks.
Squared, Ben Zorn, Ben Lipschitz. Great to see you
all
guys.
All right. Thanks a lot, guys.
Take care.
Thanks, Eric.
Bye-bye.